Good morning, Your Honors.
Yeah, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This court is back out of recess and back into session. Today's date is February 2nd, 2023. We have five matters on our calendar today. This is the second matter on our calendar. So I'll ask the marshal to call the second case.
Now calling case A221433, Kelly Bell et al. Versus St. Joseph Mutual Insurance Company, Grinnell Mutual Reinsurance Company et al.
The court's record reflect that this matter is set for oral argument today. Counsel for appellant has not appeared. After conferring with my colleagues, we have decided to go ahead, Mr. Neal, with respondent's argument in this case. This occasionally happens in the sense that we occasionally have an argument, and that's all I'm going to say, occasionally have an argument where only one party appears for the argument. It's usually counsel for appellant, where then counsel for respondent is perhaps not represented, but it happens in different ways. And so, Mr. Neal, I don't know if that's been your experience, but we just want to have you know that we're ready to listen to you. It would be the 15 minutes that you normally would be allowed, and you'll respond to questions from counsel. We recognize that you're defending the district court's decision and that, you know, you perhaps have fewer comments, but it's up to you. And so what I want to say in addition to that is just my usual comments, which is keep an eye on the clock. It should be visible on your screen as we're proceeding by a web-based conference. And then if you would identify yourself as well as the client you represent. And that's so our audio record is clear, because the audio recording that is made as a result of today's proceedings is later available on the court's website. So with that, Mr. Neal, assuming you've got the clock in front of you, you can begin with your argument when you're ready.
Very good. Good morning, Your Honors. I am John Neal. I'm an attorney representing St. Joseph Mutual Insurance Company in this matter. As a follow-up to Judge Bratwald's question, this has actually happened to me before in my 15 years. I like to think that I just briefed the case that well and the other party decided not to show up, but I know that's not the case. So thank you for allowing us to provide our position on the matter. The question before the court is essentially, did the trial court properly enter judgment under Rule 56.06? And we asked the court to address that answer in the affirmative. It sounds like, just listening to the previous case, Rule 56.06 came up in that context as well. And in the 15 years I've been doing this, is the first time I think I've seen a summary judgment entered under that rule. But I do believe it's proper in this circumstance. I'll just give some brief background. I know the court's fully briefed on the issues and the procedural of the case. I think an important fact here is that the plaintiffs or the appellants, they posited two alternative theories in their complaint. First was that my client's policy provides coverage for a dwelling unit, or in the alternative, that the agent failed to procure a policy that did not provide coverage for a dwelling unit. The case, it proceeded with a lot of discovery problems. The plaintiff's appellants failed to participate in drafting a discovery plan, providing initial disclosures, and responding to discovery. So my client initially brought a motion, a motion to compel with a motion for sanctions and dismissal. And the Benton agency joined in that motion, but separately they brought their own motion for summary judgment based on an admission in the file that basically the plaintiff's appellants admitted that they failed to ask their agent to procure a policy that provided coverage on the dwelling. The Benton agency moved for summary judgment on that basis. The day before the hearing, the plaintiff's appellants finally provided discovery responses. The court, following the hearing, issued an order stating that they intended to grant summary judgment on alternative grounds and invited the parties to make submissions. Plaintiffs and appellants did not do that, in which case, on June 29th, the court entered an order for summary judgment as to both Benton Agency and St. Joseph Mutual. The basis of the order was Rule 56.06. And that rule stands.
If I could, I really appreciate how you're focusing on the procedural developments in the case, because I think that's obviously center for the court in this case. But before you move on to talk about the grounds for granting judgment, I'd like to just pause for a moment and talk about the notice that the district court issued of its intent or its consideration of a possible summary judgment under Rule 5606. So if you would compare for me, looking at Rule 5606, that to the judge's notice. So help me understand, what do you interpret the judge's notice in this case? And I guess to be clear, I'm referring to the notice of intent to issue judgment independent of motion, right? So that's the document I'm talking about. Compare that to the rule and tell me how you think it tracks with Rule 5606.
Yeah. So Rule 56.06 has three alternative bases for granting summary judgment. The first is the court can grant the judgment for non-movement, in which case, in this case, we never moved for summary judgment under Rule
56. No, and did the district court say that it was going to grant, it was considering granting summary judgment for a non-movement? Is that in the notice?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It is. On page 2 of the court's June 6th order, the notice.
But the judge says all three things, right?
Right.
Right. So it's basically a parroting of the rule.
Yes.
Any of those things could happen.
Any of those things can happen.
Right. Okay.
Right. Yes.
All right. So looking at the rule, and going back to Rule 5606, for the third thing to happen, Rule 5606 suggests that the district court may consider summary judgment on its own initiative after identifying for the parties the material facts that may not be genuinely in dispute. So does that happen in the notice? And if so, did it happen in this notice?
Yeah, let me address that. I'll first just say that it was still proper for the court to issue judgment under A or B of Rule 56.06. But to the extent the court did it under C, which the court gives no indication in its June 29th order that it did. But if that is the case, if we look at the last paragraph of the June 6th order on page 1, and I'll just read it. The court says, procedurally, defendant Benton's motion for summary judgment requires the court to consider whether a genuine issue of material fact exists and whether defendant is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. In addressing defendant Benton's motion, the resulting analysis may implicate the relief requested by defendant St. Joseph, who seeks dismissal on a different basis. Did the court recite the facts? No, they didn't. But they referenced defendant Benton's motion of summary judgment, which did recite the facts.
So that confuses me, counsel, because you just explained there were these two alternative theories, right? And the theory as to Benton is negligent procurement. So I guess I'm not following, and maybe that's just my lack of ignorance, my ignorance, and you can help me. But I'm not following how that explains to the plaintiffs in this case that summary judgment is going to be entered on the policy, which is your connection to the plaintiffs. It's just the policy. It's not negligent procurement, right? St. Joseph's has no liability for negligent procurement.
Right. Their basis is the policy doesn't provide coverage for, because this was a loan agreement. So essentially, the plaintiff's appellants admitted that they failed to inform their agent to procure a policy on a rental dwelling. Okay, under that basis, the next question is, well, did the policy in fact provide coverage for a rental dwelling? And I think that's what the court is asking for in this paragraph I just read.
Follow up with that then, because I the other part that confuses me and didn't come out in the district court's decision is that your answer admits that the policy covers the dwelling, right? And asserts an exclusion to the policy as your defense for your reason for denying payment, right? All that's admitted in your answer.
Right.
And the district court doesn't recognize any of that in the judge's order on summary judgment. So I'm struggling to understand if the judge is going to go from the analysis, from the Benton analysis of negligent procurement, and then jump over to the policy decision, you know, whether that policy provides coverage, whether there's an exclusion for this particular type of loss. I mean, that sounds like a big leap to me, and I'm struggling to see where that leap is included in the notice that the judge gave.
Yeah, well, again, I don't think we need, I don't think the judge has to issue summary judgment on 56.06C by giving, you know, the facts and all of those things. The court has the opportunity to do that by a non-movement, which is us, because we didn't move for summary judgment, or alternatively, on grounds not raised by a party. And so when the court invited appellants, plaintiffs, and all the parties, really, they weren't required, but invited them to provide information on the claims and the factual basis for those claims, appellants and plaintiffs did not take the opportunity to do that.
And you didn't take the opportunity either. Your answer was the plaintiffs should respond, right? That's what you told the district court in your letter.
Exactly, because, Your Honor, we have tried to engage in discovery.
Yeah. It's okay. I just want to be clear. Neither party responded to the district court's order substantively, correct?
Correct. And I don't think my client should be faulted for that. No, we attempted to engage in discovery numerous times. Yep. The night before the trial, or the day before the motion hearing, excuse me, we finally were served with discovery. It's difficult for my client to parse out what those are when those are plaintiff's issues. So I don't think our failure to respond to that should be any implication on my client.
That wasn't my comment at all. So go right ahead. You go ahead with the merits of the district court's decision. Because I think what you were trying to suggest to me is whether it's an A, B, or C type of summary judgment under Rule 5606. So would you help me with that? What do you think it is? What type of summary judgment was it?
Well, I think it was proper under either A or B. First, the court gave them an opportunity to prosecute the case, because initially our motion was for failure to prosecute, sanction them, and dismiss the case.
Help me out. If we're under A, so it's granting summary judgment for a non-movement, that's certainly accurate, right? Because St. Joseph's never moved for summary judgment. So how does the district court provide notice? How does the district court's notice provide the plaintiff, alert them that this is what's going to happen? I mean, I see the language. On what grounds? So what grounds are given for that?
The paragraph I read from the June 6th order, that last paragraph on page one, alerted them that, well, granting summary judgment to Benton may implicate the relief requested by St. Joe Mutual, which deals with these alternative theories. Well, if the agent didn't procure the policy, then is there an assumption that the policy didn't provide coverage for the dwelling? And so they were alerted to at least address that. They failed to do that. And I think the court, it was proper for them to grant the summary judgment motion on either A or B for that purpose.
If I could step back a bit, I just like you to help me understand those distinctions. The rule itself doesn't say, as I read it, there are three different types of judgment independent of the motion that a district court can impose. The first is this, the second is this. And the comments seem to suggest, at least that the first sentence in the comments about this particular rule, that they're sort of lumped together. And so I guess as I'm looking at the way you're arguing and I'm looking at the rule, how can a district court grant summary judgment for a party that didn't move for it without also, in the language of C, considering summary judgment on its own initiative? Isn't that, how do you do one without the other? And if you can't do one without the other, then maybe we need to rethink what that rule really is doing. I understand disjunctive or, I understand that. And I think that's a valid point that you're making, but I'm not understanding how A can occur without also some aspect of C.
Yeah, so let's take, for example, under A, if there's enough undisputed facts in the record to support a non-movement's a motion for a non-movement, but not non-moving party, excuse me, then I think under that position, the court would have the ability under 56.06A to grant that motion. Whereas C comes into effect where the court considers these items, thinks they may be undisputed, but gives the parties an opportunity to present additional information that may correct that. I agree, Your Honor. There seems to be some sort of not a very good distinction between A and C, but I could see under that situation that would be a basis for doing it. In this
case,
I'm
not sure I follow, but I don't want to take too much of your time on that point. If there's anything else you want to explain, I still don't see how a court could grant summary judgment for a party that didn't ask for it without necessarily considering summary judgment on its own initiative. Is there a different party that's asking for summary judgment and the district court says those arguments would also apply to this other defendant, perhaps in that situation? But even then, the district court would be considering summary judgment on its own initiative as to that other defendant. So it still seems like you necessarily are doing some aspect, and maybe I'm just misunderstanding your argument or the rule a little bit here, but I was hoping you could help me with that if you're making those distinctions.
Yeah, no, very good. So here in this record, for example, we have the undisputed fact that the plaintiff's appellants did not ask their agent to procure a policy that provided insurance coverage on a dwelling, on a rented dwelling. Okay, that seems to be the main fact for the Benton agencies. Okay, and then if that's an undisputed fact, then based on that fact, there's an assumption that the policy itself never provided coverage for the dwelling. And I appreciate the record that Judge Bradfeld has already indicated, but I think under that situation, that's where A comes into play, and you don't necessarily need C, which is to identify the facts.
Right, but there seems to be, at least on appeal, an argument that there's a fact dispute regarding whether it is a rented unit, and the follow-up question of whether the daughter is part of the insured. So if on appeal, appellant's able to readily identify facts that would preclude what the district court did if they were to be developed in a certain way, then again, it seems like that would be, you'd have to get to C. You'd have to, as a district court, be operating under C if, in fact, there are different pathways, A, B, and C. It seems like because there's a disputed fact that's readily identifiable here, that sounds like it would necessarily be a C pathway.
Yeah, and the court's order doesn't indicate under which one it operated, but I think the problem here is, well, they were given an opportunity to provide the materials. Their main argument is, well, the policy was already in the record, but the rule requires them to cite that specific provision, and they never did. I mean, they never cited the specific provision in the policy, again, despite the court giving them an opportunity to address it.
Help me understand what you think the plaintiff should have cited when your client had already admitted in its answer that it issued a homeowner's policy that provided coverage for the dwelling. So what was it they needed to cite? They needed to cite the exclusion under which you are relying for denial of coverage?
Well, they need to provide in the policy where they're claiming the coverage exists. So this was
a admitted coverage in your answer, right? Am I misreading your answer? Help me out.
This is a named perils policy. So, yeah, they need to identify the perils that they're seeking coverage under. They never did that.
But counsel, your answer to the plaintiff, I mean, because the plaintiffs asserted a pretty straightforward and pretty common homeowner's coverage case, right? I mean, they asserted that this is a property for which the insurer had issued coverage. It was during the loss happened during the policy period. They submitted the claim. The insurance company denied coverage. And your client admitted all of that set of facts. So it really narrows down to whether the exclusion applies or not, right? At least on that part of their theory as to St. Joseph's.
Yeah. I mean, we admit we provided a homeowner's insurance policy, right? They still have the initial burden, even if we go to trial. If we went to trial on this case tomorrow.
Counsel, will you go back to your answer for just a second, though, and tell me, I mean, does your answer admit that you denied coverage based on an exclusion? You know, that's how I read your answer. And I'm sorry if you haven't looked at it recently. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. But,
I'm not.
That's not the point of this. That was my understanding of your defense in the case, that the whole case had already narrowed down to that point. And if I'm wrong, like you said, that's not the grounds on which the district court resolved the summary judgment.
Sure. And I'm not trying to avoid the question without seeking the answer. And I don't want to give an incorrect answer, but my belief is when you look at the record, yes, we admitted we offered and provided an insurance policy for the dwelling. But like I said, even if we went to trial, that doesn't relieve plaintiffs of their initial burden of proving that there's coverage under the policy for this specific incident, which is theft or vandalism. They still have to do that, regardless as to whether we admitted that there's a policy in effect that covers the dwelling. So we're not just automatically jumping in a trial. We're not jumping to the second phase automatically where my client has to prove the existence of an applicable exclusion.
But you do acknowledge the insurance company has the burden of proof on proving an exclusion, right?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you want to say, counsel? I made you go beyond your time. And if you want to wrap up in any way, I'm ready to let you do that.
Could I insert one question here, Judge Bradfield? Yeah. Could you just confirm for me, make sure I understand the record well, Mr. Neal, that all three defendants moved for summary judgments. The defendant Grinnell's motion was granted. And am I correct that the other two defendants' motions were still pending at the time that the district court issued the June 6th order giving notice?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So to clarify, though, Judge Johnson, I don't believe St. Joseph's ever moved for summary judgment. They moved for dismissal as a sanction for failure to provide discovery. Isn't that right, Mr. Neal?
Yeah, we never moved under 56.01.
Right. Yeah, just to clarify. Okay, thank you so much. Anything else from you, Mr. Neal? Feel free if you'd like to wrap up in any way.
No, I think that we've briefed it fairly well. I think that the real question is whether it was proper under 56.06, and given the procedural posture and plaintiff's appellant's just complete lack of participation in this case, when even given the opportunity by the court that they intended to issue summary judgment and just failed to utterly respond to that, I think the court was well within its powers to grant summary judgment under that rule, and we'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. We very much appreciate your appearance today and your response to questions. It's very helpful to the court. And so with that, this matter is now submitted to the court for a decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe.